Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, July 7th. I'm your reader, Chris Klein. First, we will turn to Eastern Iowa weather. High today in Cedar Rapids is 76 with a low of 60, and Iowa City a high of 78 with a low of 61. There is a chance of storms today, winds out of the northwest 5 to 15 miles per hour. The top weather story is interesting. July storms usually contain gusty wind. If the calendar year were to go perfectly as average, you'd find that July is usually the peak month for storm complexes with associated strong winds. One of the reasons behind this is the typical heat dome that has set up over the Great Plains. Waves of low pressure ride around the outside of the dome, utilizing more than enough thunderstorm energy that largely goes into the development of strong winds. Large damaging storm complexes can certainly develop in other months, like August, as we saw last year. However, statistically, July tends to edge them both out by a slight amount. The lead article on the front page today is He's with Jesus. Lynn Marr's student, who died in accident, was destined for greatness. This is by the Gazette Wire. Lynn Marr's student, Michael Jaramillo, according to the pastor of his Cedar Rapids church, was destined for greatness. This is a young man who was going to grow up to be a mighty man of God, a wonderful husband and great father, said Christian Shields, pastor of the Christian Life Church in Cedar Rapids. On Sunday, the pastor was at Michael's side when life support for the 11-year-old boy was discontinued. We were there holding his hand, singing over him and praying over him when he passed, Reverend Shields said. Michael was on a family outing Saturday to Adventureland, the iconic Iowa amusement park in Altoona, east of Des Moines. While on the raging river attraction, the raft the family was in capsized in the turbulent waters, trapping the family in seat belts that were meant to provide safety, but in this case prevented the family from escaping. Michael died the next day. His older brother David, who turns 16 today, was placed in a medically induced coma and is in critical condition. The next article on the front page is titled, UI Professor Helps Advise NASA on Astronaut Cancer Risk. NASA has an important opportunity to revisit its space radiation health standard. This is written by Vanessa Miller for the Gazette. Iowa City. NASA's Perseverance rover and Ingenuity helicopter have been exploring Mars since February 18th. Elon Musk said he's highly confident his SpaceX will launch people toward the red planet by 2026 or sooner. And a growing number of private spaceflight companies are eyeing manned missions closer to home, upping the cosmic chatter that's normalizing the notion of civilian space excursion. All the talk of sending more people into space, some beyond the Van Allen radiation belts, has NASA thinking more intentionally about the risk of cancer-causing radiation exposure to astronauts. What constitutes an acceptable level, how to communicate risks, and when and how to take them. NASA sets standards for limits for all the different adverse exposures associated with exposure to the space environment. University of Iowa Surgical Oncology Professor Emeritus Carol Scott Connor said, whether it's the International Space Station or going back to the moon or going to Mars, NASA has been weighing whether to update its space radiation health standard to make it more inclusive and more informative, giving astronauts, especially those eyeing longer distances, such as to the moon or Mars, are at greater risk of cancer due to radiation exposure during spaceflight. The Committee on Assessment of Strategies for Managing Cancer Risk Associated with Radiation Exposure During Crewed Space Missions, composed of 18 members, including Iowa's Scott Connor, in June issued a report supporting a NASA radiation standard update. The update would move NASA away from its old model of setting dose limits based on risk for different genders and ages to a new set universal career-long radiation on dose limit of 600 millisieverts. This dose limit should apply to all astronauts, regardless of gender and age, which would help promote equal opportunity for mission assignment and for participation in longer space flights, according to a news release from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. Under the current quantifiable standard, a male astronaut could reach his career radiation exposure limit with a 211-day mission to the International Space Station, while a woman could hit her limit with a 43-day mission. A single radiation standard that applies to all astronauts, regardless of sex and age, would provide equality of opportunity, according to the NASA committee's report. The current standard limits female astronauts to shorter spaceflight careers based on data indicating that females have a reported increase of some specific cancers from exposure to ionizing radiation compared to males. Taking risks. The new standard is more conservative, as it was determined using the risk model for the most susceptible person, a 35-year-old woman, according to Scott Connor, who joined UI Healthcare in 1995 and served as Department of Surgery Chair and in Surgical Oncology before retiring 6 years ago. She was added to the NASA committee around December to help evaluate not only the proposed set radiation limit, but how the administration communicates cancer risk to astronauts. The committee concluded that astronauts who travel on long-duration spaceflight missions are likely to be exposed to radiation levels that exceed the proposed standard and recommended that NASA develop a protocol for waiver of the proposed space radiation standard that is judicious, transparent, and involved by ethics, according to the committee report. As precursor to such a radiation risk waiver process, the committee advised NASA do a better job of assessing individual risk and communicating about its radiation health standards. A key component of risk management is evidence-based, thorough, and effective communication of the risks, according to the report. In the context of NASA's space radiation standard, risk management requires an understanding of the risks and the standard itself, as well as an understanding of how astronauts understand and interpret the risks, related standards, and both formal and informal communications about them. Although commercial spaceflight has been a hot topic recently, driving more discussion about cosmic pursuits in general, the committee's recommendations are for NASA alone. The Federal Aviation Administration, not NASA, regulates commercial spaceflight. Those flights, such as Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin space mission planned for July 20th, or Richard Branson's aboard a Virgin Galactic vessel next week, will pass through U.S. airspace during the takeoff and re-entry, but stay well within the Van Allen radiation belts. In that trips of that nature are shorter and closer to Earth, Scott Connor said, radiation exposure is less. In addition, NASA astronauts are employees, meaning they'd be protected by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. Passengers on commercial flights are not, according to Scott Connor. A spaceflight radiation risks come in the form of background galactic radiation, such as from the sun, Scott Connor said, and the Van Allen radiation belts discovered by famed UI professor James Van Allen capture those particles protecting the Earth. That's why moving beyond them heightens the risk. When an astronaut is up on the International Space Station, they're still inside the magnetic shield protection, she said. But once they get outside of that, to go to the moon or to go to Mars, then all these energetic particles from the sun and the galactic background, they're exposed. Due to the limited number of astronauts who've explored space, researchers don't have a huge body of data to assess the risk or the type of cancer they could develop. But researchers analyzed atomic bomb survivors for comparison. Lung cancer is one of the ones that showed up in atomic bomb survivors, Scott Connor said, but a lot of them are smokers. She also noted heightened risk for blood or bone cancers as well as breast cancer, but noted bomb survivors are not a perfect comparison. That's a simple, intense exposure, she said. When you talk about astronauts, it's really a different environment. The kinds of radiation that they would be exposed to is different. And it's more of a constant increased level of radiation for however many months they might be traveling in space. Ionizing radiation can lead to other long-term health problems too, experts reported, including heart concerns and cataracts. NASA should continuously strive to base its standards on the best available science as it embarks on this new phase of space travel and exploration. Hedvig Hertzschick, chairman of the radiology department at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and chairwoman of the committee that wrote the report, said in a statement, "As science on radiation-related cancer risks is constantly evolving, NASA has an important opportunity to revisit its space radiation health standards," she said. Turn to Iowa Today articles. First one, dozens injured by fireworks over holiday weekend. This is written by Michaela Ram for the Gazette. Despite ordinances prohibiting fireworks within the city limits of Cedar Rapids and Iowa City, hospitals say they still saw injuries over the holiday weekend. Dozens of patients arrived in eastern Iowa hospitals for treatment of burns, traumatic hand injuries, and even blindness in one eye. University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics still is tallying the total from the weekend, but emergency room providers put the current estimate between 20 and 30 patients with fireworks-related injuries from Friday to Monday. At least 5 cases resulted in a trip to the operating room. UIHC officials say the most common injuries were traumatic hand injuries, burns, and eye injuries, including injuries that resulted in blindness in one eye, which happened more than once over the weekend. Very serious injuries occurred in both handlers and bystanders of fireworks, UIHC officials said. Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids reported 5 patients arrived at its emergency room with injuries related to fireworks between Friday and Monday. 2 people were treated for ash or a foreign body in an eye, and others received care for burns on their legs. Some patients were treated after fireworks struck their chests or arms. Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids reported 1 patient with a burned hand related to fireworks or sparkler activity over the 4th of July weekend. An estimated 15,600 people were hospitalized with firework-related injuries in 2020, making it the most harmful year for Americans in the past 15 years, according to a report from the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. The majority of those injuries, 66%, occurred between June 2nd and July 21st of that year. Injuries to hands and fingers due to misuse of fireworks were the most common appearances at the nation's emergency rooms this past year. Injuries to the head, face, or ear region were the second most common injury, followed by injuries to the eyes as the third leading cause of injuries treated at the hospital. 18 firework-related deaths occurred in 2020, the Consumer Product Safety Commission reported. In total, the agency reports 136 firework-related deaths occurred between 2005 and 2020. According to UIHC officials, the most dangerous fireworks are mortar fireworks, which are tubes that can fire fireworks into the air. Mortar fireworks typically can be bought at roadside stands. A medical examiner in Michigan announced earlier this week that a fireworks mortar blast killed a 24-year-old goalkeeper for the Columbus Blue Jackets hockey team, the Associated Press reported. The next piece is written by Kat Russell for the Gazette, entitled Fireworks Spark Shed Fire in Cedar Rapids. A garden shed fire that was extinguished Monday night in northwest Cedar Rapids is being attributed to fireworks discharged in the area. Firefighters were dispatched at 10:24 p.m. to 627 Bartlett Court Northwest for a report of a shed, trees, and a fence on fire in the backyard, the fire department said. When they arrived, firefighters found a 10-by-15-foot garden shed was fully involved in fire. Several large trees and 50 feet of a wooden fence were burning as well. The fire department said the shed owner and neighbor reported seeing fireworks being discharged near the shed just before the fire. Fire crews were able to extinguish the fire and prevent it from spreading to other property in the area, the fire department said. The shed was destroyed. The fire department said property damage was estimated at $3,200. The shed fire is the 11th fire in Cedar Rapids to be attributed to the illegal discharge of fireworks within city limits since Friday, the fire department said. The discharge of fireworks in the city limits is prohibited, the fire department said, and can result in criminal penalties and civil liability. The next article is also written by Kat Russell for the Gazette. Driver in Highway 30 rollover wreck dies. One of his two passengers suffered serious injuries. Cedar Rapids. A 29-year-old LaPorte City man who was seriously injured Monday in a rollover wreck on U.S. Highway 30 near Interstate 380 has died. Charles Ryan Yochem was transported by Lifeguard Air Ambulance to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City with life-threatening injuries Monday afternoon, according to the Cedar Rapids Police Department. Police said the Johnson County Medical Examiner's Office notified the department Tuesday that Yochem died as the result of his injuries at 5:50 a.m. Yochem, Y-O-C-H-E-M, was one of three people injured in the single-vehicle crash Monday afternoon in which the Chevrolet Trailblazer they were traveling in rolled several times on the Interstate 380 southbound off-ramp to Highway 30. Police said Yochem was driving the Chevrolet Trailblazer on the off-ramp lane for Highway 30 and trying to merge back into Interstate 380 when he made an evasive correction to avoid another vehicle and lost control of the vehicle. It rolled several times. Police said Yochem and the front seat passenger, Deanna Marie Fugate, 49, of LaPorte City, were ejected from the vehicle. A third passenger was found seat-belted in the SUV rear passenger compartment. Fugate was transported by Area Ambulance Service to the UIHC for serious injuries. The rear passenger, Jasmine Keister, 18, of LaPorte City, was transported to Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital. She was treated for minor injuries and has since been released, police said. The next article is titled Margin Narrows for Housing Proposal Near Hickory Hill. In a 4-3 vote, Council advances second consideration for Iowa City development. This is written by Caleb McCullough for the Gazette. Iowa City. A controversial Iowa City housing development near Hickory Hill Park advanced Tuesday for the second time, but now by just one vote margin on the Iowa City Council. Mayor Bruce Teague and council members Laura Burgess, Susan Mims, and Janice Weiner voted for the proposal to rezone the tract. Council members Mazahir Sali, Pauline Taylor, and John Thomas voted against it. The proposal needs to pass a third time before the rezoning takes effect. The project, Hickory Hill Trail Estates, is a proposed rezoning of 48.75 acres northeast of Hickory Hill Park to low-density single-family housing. Led by Joe Clark and Nelson Development, the project initially was shot down by the Planning and Zoning Commission, which cited conflicts with the Comprehensive Plan and Northeast District Plan. Dozens of residents wrote in opposition to the project. The plan took three different iterations before the commission endorsed the most recent proposal. The third and latest plan reduces the number of residential lots and makes a portion of the street single loaded, removes plans for a condo complex, adds a buffer zone between the development and the park, and turns 14 acres over to the city to be added to the park. Some residents and council members were concerned Tuesday about the amount of buffer between the development and the 185-acre park, which many cited as a tranquil retreat that a busy neighborhood would disrupt. Another concern was the degree of inconsistency between the development and the city's planning documents. At a previous meeting, the council approved the first consideration of the development 6-1, with Thomas being the sole vote against. But some council members noted they approved only reluctantly, saying they couldn't vote against it if it aligned with the city codes and plans. This time, Taylor said that after looking at comments from the public, she found legitimate discrepancies. It seems that the individuals who wrote in had some sound arguments in regard to those plans, Taylor said. The Northeast District Plan, last updated in 2007, proposes two streets with separate cul-de-sacs off Scott Boulevard and First Street, while this proposal suggests a through street connecting the two. The Northeast District Plan also instructs the city to hold a buffer between developments and sensitive areas, which was a key point informing the council's decision. Mims said the 14-acre space being added to the park will provide at least a 100-foot buffer and screening. Council members in favor wanted to direct the city staff to plant trees to block the view of the development from people in the park. I think with 100 feet we can get quite a bit of screening to protect that view from these properties and from these houses, Mims said during the meeting. Thomas said he does not expect the developer's plans to change between now and the third consideration of the proposal, but there still is room for changes to the council's directions. It's an ongoing negotiation, and that negotiation continues, he said. It may continue even after the approval process. Next is written by Aaron Jordan for the Gazette. Freedom Riders Pause, Truth and Reconciliation Committee. Group says meetings too focused on issues raised by white people. Iowa City. The Iowa Freedom Riders, an Iowa City-based group that advocates for the liberation and joy of black and brown people, has paused meetings of the People's Truth and Reconciliation Committee, a group formed in March as an alternative to the city-created commission. In a statement released Sunday on Twitter, the Freedom Riders said the PTRC meetings have steered off course and have become a place for white people to come and discuss their issues, rather than a place for people of color to voice concerns or ask questions. When we started doing these meetings, we hoped it would be a safe and healing place for Black and Brown people in Johnson County to discuss the injustices they face on a daily basis, whether that is wrongful eviction notices, armed guards in a Casey's, or walking while Black, the statement said. Issues raised by white people at the meetings are valid, but are more likely to be heard by those in power, the group said. The Freedom Riders statement says they will step back from the committee to see how they can better achieve what we set out to do. The Freedom Riders formed a Truth and Reckoning Commission in March with the goals of truth-telling, reparations for marginalized groups, creating a space for healing and education, KWWL television station reported. The group was an alternative to the Iowa City Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a 9-member organization created this past year by the Iowa City Council in response to demands from the Black Lives Matter movement. That group is charged with hearing evidence of racial injustice in Iowa City. Now to the Insight page and the community letter. We have one today, submitted by Ellen Ballas of Iowa City. It's titled, Miller Meeks Seeks Funding But Opposes Bill. U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, who voted against the recent infrastructure bill called Invest in America Act, figured out the formula to satisfy her Republican overlords, obstruct Democratic legislation, then fool constituents by making false statements. Miller Meeks requested over $14 million in funding for earmarks before an April deadline, long before she falsely stated in July that she opposed the bill because the overarching legislation was too costly, unpaid for, and would drive up deficits. Obviously, Miller Meeks doesn't care how her second district project requests are funded. She still could receive the funding despite opposing the legislation if the bill becomes law. Moreover, it has not been determined who will eventually pay for the earmarks, even though Miller Meeks claimed it would continue to drive both our deficit and inflation. First, the bill is an authorization measure, not an appropriations bill. Second, Representative Peter DeFazio, who sponsored the bill, explained that the Ways and Means Committee, the chief tax writing committee in the House, has held a number of hearings, and there are members of that committee that have a multiplicity of ideas. Second district voters need a new representative. Again, this was submitted by Ellen Ballas of Iowa City. Now, here are some things to do today. Community, Cedar Rapids Area Genealogy Library. Research your family tree with the help of library volunteers. The library is located in the lower level of the Masonic Building. When? 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Where? Public Library, 1st Avenue Southeast, Cedar Rapids. Cost? Free. Ages? All ages. Next, museum exhibit. Grant Wood revealed rarely seen works by an American master. While known for his iconic American Gothic and other regionalist works from his mature style, Grant Wood was constantly exploring styles, techniques, and media. Rarely seen paintings will be joined by diverse metalwork pieces, drawings, and studies to construct a fuller view of Wood's genius. When? Noon to 4 p.m. Where? Cedar Rapids Museum of Art, 410 3rd Avenue Southeast, Cedar Rapids. Cost free. Ages, all ages. Hobby, Open Studio Craft Night. This open studio will allow you to work with an instructor to design and create your project. The instructor will be in touch with each of you and will provide project options. When? 6 to 8 p.m. Where? Kirkwood Community College, Horticultural Floral Careers, 6301 Kirkwood Boulevard, Southwest, Cedar Rapids. Cost, $29. Materials fee, $10. Eastern Iowa Briefs, West Branch. Hoover Museum exhibits reopen with timed entry ticket system. The Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum has reopened, and visitors will be able to view the museum exhibits. Timed entry tickets must be purchased online in advance. The well-being of visitors and staff is the library's top priority, and staff have adjusted the visitor experience to meet current health and safety guidelines. Hours of operation will be Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Visitors may purchase a maximum of 6 tickets per visit. The museum gift shop and research room remain closed to the public. All educational programs will remain as online programs only. The buildings on the grounds of the Herbert Hoover National Historic Site are open, but social distancing is in place. To plan your visit and review the safety measures, visit hooverarchives.gov. Online time tickets may be purchased at buyticketing.com events 269 list. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, July 7th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Betty Ruth Emmerich of Tipton, age 94, passed away Sunday, July 4th, while under the care of Mercy, Iowa City. She was an eye donor for the Iowa Donor Network. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, July 9th at Fry Funeral Home, Tipton. Funeral services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 10th at First United Church of Christ in Tipton, with a short visitation 1 hour prior, starting at 9:30 a.m. Burial will be in Woodbridge Cemetery, Buchanan. Memorial funds have been created for Camp Courageous, First United Church of Christ, and Tipton's Cedar County Senior Dining, since she was on the board of directors and delivered Meals on Wheels for years. Next, Lurie Susan Fairley, age 68, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, July 4th. A visitation will be held from 4 to 6 p.m. Thursday, July 8th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids. A funeral mass will take place at 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 9th at St. Ludmilla Catholic Church in Cedar Rapids. Next, Judy So Yu Pei, P-E-I, age 95, of Cedar Rapids, died Sunday, July 4th. A visitation will be held from 1 to 2 p.m. Saturday, July 10th at Cedar Memorial Stateroom, with a private family service following. Burial will take place in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Next is John Joseph Waha, W-A-C-H-A, age 47, of Huxley, formerly of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, June 29th in Huxley. Graveside services, 1 p.m. Saturday at St. Patrick's Cemetery, Fairfax, by the Reverend Mark Murphy. Tehan Funeral Home and Cremation is assisting the family. Mary Patricia Pat Barker Hill, age 85, of Cedar Rapids, the Wicker Lady, passed July 3rd after failing health and dementia at Cottage Grove Place in Cedar Rapids, where she has resided since 2018. Funeral Mass will be 10 a.m. Friday, July 9th at Immaculate Conception Church, 3rd Avenue Southeast, Cedar Rapids. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 8th at the Cedar Memorial Chapel Stateroom. Burial held at Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. John V. Johnson, age 87, of North Liberty, passed away Sunday, July 4th. Private family services are planned. Memorial donations may be directed to St. Jude Children's Hospital. Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City is handling arrangements. Daniel Lee Martin of Cedar Rapids, A memorial service will be held 11 a.m. Saturday, July 10th at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories by the Reverend Vicki Engelman of United Church of Christ Church, Inernment, Dunkard Cemetery in Midway, Iowa. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of the arrangements. Marion Forer Young, age 77, died peacefully Monday, July 5th, after a brief illness surrounded by the unconditional love she bestowed on her family. There is no service planned. Inernment, Linwood Cemetery, Cedar Rapids, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids, assisted the family. Lowell Jean Kleinmeyer, age 68, of Conroy, lost a 7-year battle with renal cell carcinoma on Sunday, July 4th, surrounded by his family at home. He fought like a true Marine until the end. A celebration of life service will be 10:30 a.m. Friday, July 9th, at St. Paul United Methodist Church in Williamsburg. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday at Powell Funeral Home in Williamsburg. Burial will be at Pilot Grove Cemetery near Williamsburg with military rites by Iberg Polson, VFW Post number 8797 of Williamsburg. Robert A. Bob Price, age 83, of Iowa City, died Thursday, July 1st, on his birthday at Briarwood Healthcare Center, where he had resided since September of last year, and where he had been so lovingly cared for. His family will always remember and cherish these beautiful people. Thank you. A time for family and friends to gather for a visitation will be from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Friday, July 9th at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service, followed by a 2:30 p.m. graveside service at Memory Garden Cemetery in Iowa City. Steve Clint, age 54, of Hiawatha, passed away Sunday, July 4th at his home, surrounded by his loving family. A private family service will take place at a later date. Richard Lee Olmsted Sr., age 76, of Hiawatha, passed away July 3rd at Mercy Medical Center. A celebration of life will take place from 2 to 6 p.m. Sunday, July 25th at the American Legion in Hiawatha. Stephen Allen Carlson, life will be A celebration of Stephen Allen Carlson's life will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. Saturday, August 14th at the Kirkwood Room, 515 Kirkwood Avenue, Iowa City. Brief remarks will begin at 3:15 p.m., followed by a time for people to share their remembrances. Light refreshments will be served. Stephen Allen Carlson died December 27, 2020, at age 74, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Memorial contributions may be made to parents and friends of lesbians and gays, PFLAG is the acronym, at www.pflag.org. Cynthia Sydney Pappas, age 78, of Marion, passed away Monday, July 5th at Manor Care in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. No services are planned at this time. Juliana Harden Dowell, age 78, passed away peacefully July 2nd at Bickford Assisted Living in Iowa City. Her celebration of life will be held at 1 p.m. Sunday, July 11th at Zion Lutheran Church of Iowa City, 310 North Johnson Street. Masks are kindly requested. Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service is handling arrangements for Juliana. Mary P. Eno, E-N-O, passed away July 4th at the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County. She was 63 years old. July 9th at Gaya Mary's family will receive guests from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, July 9th at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. A memorial mass is scheduled for 10 a.m. Saturday, July 10th at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Iowa City. Norma Rose, née Mask Crab, Arlington, Texas, age 78. Passed away after a brief illness on July 2nd. A private family service is planned. Please direct any memorial to the American Cancer Society. Carolyn Lynn Ann Dickey, age 78, of Marion, Iowa, passed away Monday, July 5th, at Emory Place Assisted Living in Robbins. Family will meet friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, July 16th at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion. A funeral mass will take place at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, July 17th at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Marion, officiated by the Reverend David O'Connor, with a visitation 1 hour prior. Burial will follow at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. Marla Walters, age 78, of Monticello, died Sunday, July 4th at St. Luke's Hospital, Cedar Rapids. Funeral services will be held 11 a.m. Thursday, July 8th at Wayne Zion Lutheran Church, rural Monticello, with interment in Wade Zion Cemetery. Dorothy M. Benhart, 94, formerly of Oxford Junction, passed away Friday, July 2nd at her home in Pinnacon Place in Anamosa. Her funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, July 8th at Oxford Junction United Methodist Church. A visitation will be held prior to her service from 9 to 11 a.m. Burial will take place at Mayflower Cemetery in Oxford Junction, Dawson. Funeral services is caring for her family. Andrew James Lawrence Lorimer ended his suffering in his earthly life on June 29th. A celebration of life will be held July 9th in Groton, Connecticut for his Navy family. A local celebration of life will be held from 1 to 4 p.m. July 24th at Sally's on Broadway, in Springville, Iowa. Tian Funeral Home is serving the family. Dolores Jean Clark, age 80 years, of Raymore, Missouri, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away from a long illness on July 2nd. Cremation has taken place. A memorial service is being planned at Foxwood Springs. Interment will be held at a later date in Iowa. Angela Nicole Barron, age 40, a 10-year resident of the Brookdale neighborhood in Naperville, Illinois, passed away peacefully July 2nd at her home surrounded by the love of her family after an impossibly difficult battle with breast cancer. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, July 8th. At Community Christian Church, 1635 Emerson Lane, Naperville, Illinois. A celebration of Angie's life will be held at 10 a.m. Friday, July 9th at the church with a reception to follow. A family graveside service will be held at 6:30 p.m. Saturday, July 10th at Calvary Cemetery in Victor. And finally, Clarence F. Cadleck, 101, of Robbins, formerly of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully early Monday, July 5th, while living with a family member. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday at Papich Cuba Funeral Home, East, 1228 2nd Street Southeast, Cedar Rapids. Anyone attending the visitation is respectfully requested to wear a mask and practice social distancing. In other notices from Decorah, Amy Harriet Hovden Rue, age 99, died Monday, July 5th. Hiawatha, Doreen Sue Curry, 85, died Monday, July 5th. In Hills, John Henry Seelman, age 78, died Wednesday, June 30th. Hoppington, Deborah Ann LeClear, 66, died Sunday, July 4th. In Maquoketa, Crystal Roberts, age 40, died Sunday, July 4th. Maquoketa, Rebecca Becky Shady, age 61, died Friday, July 2nd. In Marengo, Neil Joseph McMahon, age 79, died Tuesday, July 6th. Marion, Seth Michael Kuba, age 30, died Sunday, July 4th. Waverly, Terry Young, age 56, died Thursday, July 1st. And West Union, John Genevieve Francis McNeil, age 96, died Sunday, July 4th. Now we turn to sports. In the sideline section, Iowa Athletics, Roy Marble leads Hall of Fame class, Iowa City. The late Roy Marble Jr. is one of nine former athletes and administrators in the University of Iowa 2021 Hall of Fame class, the school announced on Tuesday. Marble, 1986 through 89, ranks second in program history in career scoring with 2,116 points. Two notable football players being enshrined are Frank Kinney Holbrook, 1895-97, the first black athlete to compete for the University of Iowa, and Ed Podolak, 1966-68, a first-team All-Big Ten running back in 1968. Podolak ran for 286 yards on 17 attempts against Northwestern, a school and Big Ten record at the time. He went on to play in the NFL and earned a Super Bowl ring with the Kansas City Chiefs in 1970. The other members of the class are Dan Bachman, men's gymnastics, 1982-86, Carrie Hamill, volleyball, 1985-89, Christy Hanks, softball, 1999-2002, Kristen Holmes, field hockey, 1992-96, Fred Mims, administration, Diane Nakuri, track cross country, 2006-2008, and Brad Penrith, wrestling, 1984-88. The 10-person class will be inducted September 3rd, the day before Iowa's football season opener against Indiana. Next, tee times announced for John Deere Classic, Byline Silvis, Illinois. Tee times for the first two rounds of the PGA Tour's John Deere Classic at TPC Deer Run were announced Tuesday. Cedar Rapids native Zach Johnson will be playing partners with Daniel Berger and Kevin Na, and will tee off at 12:43 p.m. in Thursday's first round and 7:18 a.m. in Friday's second round. Alex Schaake, S-C-H-A-A-K-E, who completed his University of Iowa golf career this spring, will play at 8:46 a.m. Thursday and at 2:11 p.m. on Friday. Former Iowa State golfers Chris Baker and Tripp Kinney are in the same threesome and will tee off Thursday at 2 p.m. and Friday at 8:35 a.m. The tourney will be on Golf Channel both days from 2 to 5 p.m., then will be on KGAN at the same times on Saturday and Sunday. High school softball, no containing Mustangs Bentley. Mount Vernon gets big HR at home field. This is written by Jeff Linder for the Gazette. Mount Vernon, it's new, It's beautiful and it's spacious. But Van Meter family softball field wasn't spacious enough to contain Maya Bentley. Overcoming the park's deep dimensions and a breeze that was blowing in, Bentley crushed her 8th home run of the year. The 3-run shot helped push second-ranked Mount Vernon past Center Point Urbana, 8-0, in a Class 3A softball regional quarterfinal last night. "Sometimes you get that pitch that is right down the middle," Bentley said. "That one felt really good." "How good?" "How about 235 feet? Mount Vernon, 32-4, scored 3 runs in the first inning, then added 3 more on Bentley's blast in the second. That was more than enough to send the Mustangs to the second round. They'll host Independence, 18-24, in a regional semifinal at 5 p.m. Friday. "That was a nice solid win," Mustangs coach Robin Brand said. "That's a nice team we beat, a team that has gotten better." The Mustangs handled CPU, 14-21, in a regular season doubleheader, 9-0 and 12-0. This was more of the same. Jenna Sprague pitched a 4-hit shutout, striking out 10. "I know my best defense has my back all the time, and I know that no matter where I place the ball, it's going to move," said Sprague, 23-2, whose ERA dipped to 1.12. "I knew we could handle them. We did well against them in the regular season." The artificial turf at the Van Meter facility is a gem that will lend itself more to gappers than homers. The dimensions are 200 feet down the lines, 220 to center field. But with two on and one out in the bottom of the second, Bentley got a hold of one that sailed into the teeth of a southerly breeze and landed well beyond the fence in center. It was the first Van Meter home run. "I really like the field. We're still getting a feel for it," Bentley said. "It's definitely an advantage. I love running the bases. A home run trot is okay, too." Mount Vernon struck immediately. With one out in the bottom of the first, Bentley singled and Lauren Ryan walked. Sprague singled home one run. Then, one out later, Ashlyn Steen hit a 2-run single to make it 3-0. CPU got a runner to second base on 3 occasions, but that was as close as the Stormin' Pointers came to scoring against Sprague. The Mustangs tacked on a pair of unearned runs in the 6th. Bentley, Sprague, and Steen had 3 hits apiece for the winners. Bentley and Nadia Telecki scored twice apiece. We have time for one more. About minor league baseball. Isola finishes triple shy of hitting a cycle. This is written by Jeff Johnson for the Gazette. Catcher helps lead Cedar Rapids past Peoria 10-2. Hitting a single, double, triple, and home run in the same game doesn't happen very often, and it's one of baseball's more sacred achievements. But it probably wasn't very realistic for Alex Isola of the Cedar Rapids Colonels to get it done in his final at-bat last night in the 7th inning. Veterans Memorial Stadium is a triples ballpark if you can hit it to the cavernous gap in right center field, but triples aren't exactly Isola's thing. He hasn't had one in the first 67 games of his professional career. He didn't have any in his 3-year college career in Utah, Yavapai Junior College in Arizona, or Texas Christian. "I think I had one in high school," Isola smiled after his team blasted Peoria 10-2. "I'm not a fast guy, I'm a catcher." No cycle, but it still was a heck of a game for the 22-year-old California native. His 3-run home run in the 2nd inning gave the Colonels a nice early lead. Isola doesn't have the highest batting average around at .234, but his .817 on-base plus slugging leads the team. That's because he has 7 home runs and a team-high 31 walks. Our hitting coach, Bryce Berg, does a great job of giving us some of the data. So for me, I try and go in with the understanding of what I'm going to do, Isola said. The big thing with the walks is just don't give away at-bats. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, July 7th. I'm your reader, Chris Klein. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.